When it comes to young people, it seems self-evident that if they're going to be good students, they're going to need good teachers. But is that really so? Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. I'm Steve Paikin. We are here taking part in the second Equinox Summit, and this time our focus is on education. This gathering of educators, thinkers, and activists was organized by the WGSI, the Waterloo Global Science Initiative. That's a partnership between the Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo. This summit is the final stop in TVO's year-long multi-platform Learning 2030 series, which has been examining the nature of education of tomorrow, today. What kind of classroom awaits the child born today? And what kind of post-secondary system will he or she graduate into in the year 2030? Tonight, in our latest contribution to the series, we are asking, in a very fast-changing world, how do you teach the young that they will need to learn continuously and do it on their own initiative for the rest of their lives? That's tonight, on the agenda, live from Waterloo, Ontario.
Funding for the Agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leader since 1879. More information is available at icao.on.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Yes, we're back at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, for the second of five programs all week long looking at the future of schools and learning. And if you weren't able to be here tonight in person, we certainly have ways for you to participate in our programming this evening. We are live streaming all of tonight's proceedings at tvo.org/learning2030, special website for that. Our producers are hosting a live chat at that site, also at our regular website, theagenda.tvo.org. You can also join in via Twitter. We've got a couple of hashtags we'd like you to use, hashtag Learning2030 or hashtag EQX13. That's for Equinox 2013, EQX13. Let's get to this. You have heard the iconic words from Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, "Hey teacher, leave them kids alone," the hymn of disaffected and disengaged students around the world. On last night's program, we pointed out a very scary statistic. Students in grade 5, their level of engagement by the time they get to grade 11 is cut in half. Tonight, we're going to take that one step further and ask, what would happen if teachers were actually to leave them kids alone? Tonight, it's all about homeschoolers, unschoolers, and other self-directed learners and their impact on the future of teaching and learning. And so, for that, we welcome Michael Reist. He is the author of What Every Parent Should Know About School. He's the former head of the English department at Caledon East's Robert F. Hall Catholic Secondary School. That's just a little over an hour from here. Nikhil Goyal is the author of One Size Does Not Fit All, A Student's Assessment of Education. He comes to us tonight from New York City. Samuel Levin, he's the founder of the Independent Project at Monument Mountain Regional High School in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He's now a student at Oxford University overseas. Kayla Cohen also comes to us tonight from London, UK. She has left school before finishing high school to educate herself. And finally, Noor Siddiqui is the 2012 Teal Fellow. She is the co-founder of something called Remedy, and she comes to us tonight from San Francisco, California. And I wonder if we'd all show them a lovely Waterloo, Ontario welcome. Thank you. Sam, I'm tempted to ask off the top how a guy who lives in Massachusetts can possibly be a Yankee fan, but we're going to leave that for another day.
Sounds good.
What I do want to know, actually, is about the Independent Project, which you're all about. What is it?
So the Independent Project, Steve, was it was a school that I designed and implemented at my public high school in Western Massachusetts, as you said. It was a school within a school, and it was led by students.
How old are you?
I'm 20.
You're 20, and you developed this at the age of?
It's a good question. 16, 17.
And when you came forward with this idea of, I need to create a new school to deal with problems and issues that you're not dealing with, what was the reaction?
oh, everyone said, that's fine, go ahead. No. Yeah, we were met with a lot of resistance. I was met with a lot of resistance, a lot of anger, but obviously not so much that we couldn't make it happen in the end.
We've got some tape from a documentary that's been done about your project, so let's play a little of that tape now, and then we'll come back and chat some more, okay? Shelly, let's roll this if we can. Thanks.
It's crazy that in a system that is meant to teach and help the youth, there's no voice from the youth at all.
If students designed their own schools, what would school look like?
Crime and punishment is first and foremost a test.
Probably something like this. No quizzes, no grades, not even classes.
I think Dostoevsky actually might disagree with me on that.
And most of the time, no teachers or any adults in the classroom.
So it's a completely alternative academic program here at Monument. We have 9 kids in it, and we look at the 4 main bodies of learning, you know, English, math, social sciences, and natural sciences.
I think the most valuable thing with these sorts of problems is
this is a school within a public high school designed by the students themselves. The program, known as the Independent Project, runs for 1 semester and is divided into 3 parts. All follow the same basic rule, design your own learning.
Now, some people are going to assume that this works for the sort of smarty-pants students who are overachievers and maybe whose parents grew up in the 60s and, you know, all of that. Would that be accurate?
Well, I understand the assumption completely, but it couldn't be more wrong. So one of the things most exciting about the Independent Project was that it was for all kinds of students. Sure, students who were getting straight A's, top of their class, and were just actually bored because school wasn't challenging them, but also students who were on the edge of dropping out. You know, several students who were really about to drop out of high school, students who had been diagnosed with learning difficulties. So really, it spanned the spectrum, and as we saw, it worked for all of them.
If you were a completely unmotivated, disengaged student, or maybe had learning disabilities, and you got into this program, what was the effect?
The effect, while there were a wide range of effects, the effects were that you, of course, continued to struggle and face challenges, but also that you became more open-minded, more excited about school, pursuing your own learning, that you graduated high school, and a lot of these people have gone on. One of them, who was on the edge of dropping out of high school, is now a published writer.
Huh. How do you decide who gets in?
That's a good question. So at my high school, we focused just on kids who wanted to do it. So all we wanted to make sure was that you were serious about it, that you weren't just signing up for it because you had heard about it. So we had an application process, but all that really was saying, do you really want to do this? And then we let you in.
We have heard that this formula of yours has been replicated now at other schools as well. Does it look like teachers and principals are warming up to this idea?
Well, the good thing about us having done it first at our school is now other kids and other teachers and other principals around the world can say, well, you may not think this is going to work, but it did. So yeah, it's starting to spread and it's popping up all over the place and sometimes in an even bigger and more exciting way than it happened at my school.
Okay, let's talk to Kayla beside you. Kayla, thank you for being here tonight all the way from London, UK. How old are you, Kayla?
I'm 18.
And how old were you when you decided school is not working for me and I'm leaving?
A bit too late for my liking, to be honest. 17 years old.
So it just happened recently?
Yeah.
And you say, a bit too late for my liking. You wish you'd done it years ago?
Yeah, I do, because I think that we're enrolled at school at a very early age and with impressionable minds, and I feel I've been susceptible to quite a narrow value system that has formed the basis of at least the UK's mainstream education.
So what is it about the education you were getting that you thought, I am a square peg and this is a round hole and this is just never going to work for me?
That's a good question. I think I couldn't find its relevance to me, not only in terms of employability, but just as a human being. I felt myself ask what's called, which I really hate this term, but the existential questions. Mm-hmm. And I felt that to be very taboo at school. And when I tried to ask some, perhaps around the curriculum, I didn't feel like that was received fantastically by everyone.
One of the things we heard last night is that the education system does a pretty good job educating you if you are quote-unquote normal. But if you're a little bit extraordinary, it doesn't do such a good job. I don't mean to put you on the spot or make you feel awkward or anything like that, but it may well, I mean, what I'm hearing is, it just didn't feel right for you. You've got bigger ideas or bigger dreams and you felt very pinched in by the public school system. Am I getting close?
Yeah, I guess, but I wouldn't, I feel frustrated at this term normal because I felt like a lot of people would have liked to do what I did. But what I felt frustrated by was that they didn't perceive their autonomy in doing this. A lot of people felt like I was lucky for having done this, and I felt you can do the exact same thing. My school actually supported me and allowed me to do this for 4 out of 5 days, and then actually less and less because of some requirements. But
I'm presuming you needed your parents' permission to do this.
Yeah.
You did.
Well, not particularly. I'm a separate human.
You didn't need their permission to do it?
I wanted their support. I wanted to leave school entirely, but they had invested quite a lot in my education, and also the issue of choice. But my parents really listened to me, and
they came around.
Yeah,
and they do support your decision.
Absolutely, we have. My dad took me on leaf studies, and television studies was a personal favorite of ours.
Television studies?
Yeah. We turn everything into studies now. You can just put the word at the end, and it's suddenly worthwhile. Ah.
So watching TV is suddenly television studies.
Yeah. We analyze it afterwards.
It's an accredited course. I see. Well, I mean, let me ask the sort of obvious question here, is that what are you learning now? How do you educate yourself?
At the moment?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're learning all the time.
But you're not going to classes, so what are you doing with your days?
Sorry, I've finished this process. I've graduated, as it were, but I was really, from such a structured environment to totally deciding how you do this, it was an incredible position of autonomy. I basically said to myself, I'm not going to, even though it may come naturally, to put in place the tyranny which I felt I was so used to. I really tried to resist that. So actually, it was quite an exhausting process of always challenging myself, saying, have I already just become so set in my ways? To give you some concrete things, a day in the life of Kayla would be wake up when the sun comes in, see my deadlines, and go to the library. I like to find all the different libraries in London. Go work in an interesting place, maybe by the Thames, and work around. I visited a lot of university professors who agreed to speak to me individually. And I'd always do exercise. I'd always go into nature.
So despite television studies being your favorite subject, you actually are still learning.
Of course.
Of course. Even though you're not going off, like probably many of your friends, to post-secondary, you are still learning.
Well, yeah, because define learning, you know, like, isn't that just perceiving and trying to think critically, perhaps, about those perceptions?
Okay, I want to show some more tape now. This is a clip from a short video about a family whose three sons took a multi-year break from school, kind of like you, on a bigger platform in some respects. Okay, let's roll that tape, please, Sheldon.
Our boys started out in the traditional school system. It wasn't until our oldest was in grade 4 that we really had to sit down and decide whether or not homeschooling was something that we were going to pursue, because it just had become quite apparent that school wasn't a good fit for him.
It was almost catering to a type of kid that I just wasn't. It wanted me to learn in a certain way that I couldn't. For whatever reason, I just wasn't absorbing the information that they were giving me, and I just, that made me frustrated, naturally. What kid wants to know that he can't learn?
There are a lot of children whose needs don't get met at school. And the results of that can be, as benign as a child just not learning, or maybe a child not loving school. But the most dangerous time is when you have a child become, say, a behavioral child, or they turn inward and become depressed.
Michael, let's get you into the conversation now. Any of that sound familiar?
Very familiar.
How come?
We homeschooled our four children. I was an English teacher for 30 years in the Ontario educational system. We had four children, three boys and a girl. When the first one was old enough to go to school, we bought the backpack, we bought the lunch pail. We were fully expecting this was going to be a wonderful experience. Within a few weeks, months, we realized that this was not working.
What wasn't working?
Well, Thomas was very stressed. The day was too long.
How old was Thomas at this time?
He was four years old at the time.
Okay.
The day was far too long. He came home exhausted. The social interactions were very negative. So my wife had met some people in the community who were homeschooling. I didn't even know that homeschooling existed. I didn't know that it was an option. And we got talking to that family, we visited some families, and we made the decision to keep Thomas home. And for the next 14 years, we homeschooled. Thomas went to high school, all four went to high school eventually. But it totally revolutionized our lives. It certainly revolutionized my life as a teacher, because I was totally a product of the system. I believed that students need teachers. And one of the things I learned from homeschooling was that, well, to quote Aristotle, all people are by nature curious. And if we can harness that curiosity and not kill it and not squelch it, the possibilities are unbelievable. And homeschooling opened up a whole new vista for me personally and for our family.
Why did you, if it was working so well, why did you eventually allow the kids to go to high school?
Well, that's a decision that all homeschoolers have to make, because in the province of Ontario, to get into post-secondary, you need 30 credits. And you can go through the system and you cash in your 30 credits and the university will accept you with marks and so on. To homeschool in high school in Ontario is a much greater challenge, because when you come to the post-secondary institution, you have to use other ways of gaining acceptance. Mm-hmm. The other thing is socialization. I think that when kids reach 14, they're wanting to expand their horizons. And I think that that was just a natural evolution, that they wanted to get out in the world and see what was out there.
Did any of your children ever chafe at your homeschooling?
No, and that's an important point. In our particular case, the kids always had the choice to go back tomorrow. We didn't force them to be at home. It was always a choice, and the kids never chose to go back.
Now, you're a real teacher.
I'm a real teacher in the classroom every day for 30 years.
I'm trying to imagine the conversations you had with your colleagues when you said, school is good enough for everybody else's kids, but not for mine.
Yes, well, it was a very schizophrenic existence, I can tell you. And I would come home at night after having marked my papers and everybody sitting in rows and behaving and filling in their worksheets dutifully. And I would come home to my unschooled home and you couldn't see the rug for all the toys, everything was in chaos. And I had to make this psychological leap every night from structure and control and order into organic, spontaneous, beautiful learning. And eventually I did learn to just put my hands in the air and say, this is good, But yeah, around the staff room table, it was definitely an issue. And homeschoolers, the number one question they always get asked is, what about socialization? Mm-hmm. And my, you know, my response is that socialization is code for what about fitting in? What about conformity? What about conforming to the dictates of society? That's really what socialization is about. And the other thing that schooled people are not willing to talk about is the negative socialization at school. Nobody ever looks at school and looks at what the kid that comes out of school kind of warped and distorted and deformed and say, what about socialization?
Well, because they got picked on every day is what you're saying.
Exactly. For all kinds of reasons, yeah. Kids are deformed by school.
Right.
And we never ask, well, what was it about school that deformed them? Well, it was the kind of socialization that goes on there. But if a homeschooled kid is allowed to grow organically and naturally, we get all fearful about socialization. Hmm. But really what you're talking about is social conformity.
Okay, bring us up to date on the story now. The four kids are how old and where are they?
Thomas turned 25 yesterday. He's doing a doctorate in aerospace engineering at the U of T Aerospace Institute. Rachel is doing a master's in peace and conflict studies at the University of Waterloo, just here across the street. She's currently doing an internship in Washington, D.C. Justin just finished a political science degree at Carleton in Ottawa. And Luke is in concurrent ed at Laurentian in Sudbury.
Clearly,
all four went
clearly
on.
You've ruined their lives. Congratulations, that's 4 for 4. That's pretty good.
Thank you.
Noor, let's bring you into the conversation. How old are you?
19.
19, so you've just finished high school. And of course, you're going to go on to college or university now, right?
Not at the moment.
Not at the moment. What's the plan, Noor?
Right now, I'm working on a company.
You're working on a company.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your friends are, of course, taking a different path. They are going on to college or university. How come you're not?
I'm part of a program called the Teal Fellowship, and what the fellowship allows is for students, entrepreneurs, young people to sort of have 2 years of runway to work on whatever they want.
This is called the Teal Fellowship, T-H-I-E-L.
Correct.
Named after one of the original backers of Facebook and PayPal.
Correct.
So he's a guy with some resources, and he's created these scholarships, and how did you get it?
It's just an application process. While I was applying to university, I saw the fellowship, and it was kind of the opportunity that I've been looking for to sort of work on some problems that you can't work on while you're in university and have access to some people who you don't have access to at university.
And you're in San Francisco, so you're kind of in the hotbed of high tech in the whole world.
Correct.
Right. And what are you going to be doing?
Well, right now what we're doing is we're building a teleconsulting application on Google Glass. So,
sorry, English. Try again? What?
So there's Skype on your computer.
Yeah.
And Google Glass is one of the wearable computing devices that have just hit the market.
Google Glass?
Google Glass.
I don't know about that one. What is Google Glass?
So it's basically a device that you wear on your face, and it allows you to have access to your Twitter feed, your Facebook. It allows you to transmit video. It's just basically a smartphone on your face.
A smartphone on your face? So
yeah.
You wear it like glasses?
Correct.
All the way around, like regular glasses?
Yep.
And you, what do you do again? It sounds very Dick Tracy. Oh no, that'd be the wristwatch, which is also coming out, I've heard. Okay, but you're developing this?
No, Google's developing Google Glass, mm-hmm. And what we're working on is a teleconsulting solution that's going to run on top of Glass. So it's kind of like Skype runs on your computer, so Remedy runs on Google Glass.
Okay. Do you not, I mean, this is the obvious question, do you not want what everybody calls a nice, well-rounded post-secondary education experience?
I think being well-rounded is being mediocre. I think that the Picassos of the world should paint, and I think the Fitzgeralds of the world should write, and I think that Michael Phelps should swim. So I think that the best way to become exemplary, to become excellent, is to focus. And I think that students today aren't focusing enough, and that's why we have people who aren't achieving as much as they should.
Do you worry when you're 40 or 50 years old that you'll look back and say, 4 years at UCLA would have been a hell of a lot of fun?
No, I don't think I'll look back and think that.
You do not think that?
I think that what's fun is building things and creating things and making things, and that's what I think people should be spending their time on. And when I was in school, I really felt like people weren't pushing anyone hard enough, right? There wasn't enough A project had a deadline of 2 weeks, but you know, really it could have gotten done in a night. And I think it's unacceptable that in a place where there are so many resources, we weren't pushing harder and asking people to do more with their time. You know, Bill Gates says, to those to whom much has been given, much is expected, right? So coming from the States, coming from, you know, the land of opportunity, I think that people should have higher standards for what they want to achieve in life and what they want to achieve out of their education. And it should be more than just, you know, it should be more than just a job. They should think about how what they're doing is going to contribute to society, how it's going to fit into, you know, the larger picture, not just nationally, but internationally. So that's what I think people should be doing with their time. And that's what I want to look back at my life and say that, you know, that's what I did with my life, not had fun.
And how long does the Thiel Scholarship or Fellowship last?
2 years.
2 years. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Okay, Nikhil, you ready?
Yeah.
You're the author of a book called One Size Does Not Fit All. Unlike Kaylee, you did finish high school.
Yes.
You're what? You're 18 as well?
I'm 18.
You're 18. What was your high school? First of all, you went to high school on Long Island?
Yes.
What was the experience like?
So I moved on Long Island from Bethpage, New York to Syosset, New York in the summer of 2010, so from middle of 9th and 10th grade. So my high school experience, at least in Syosset, was pretty horrible. It was a devastating experience in the sense that it was a ruthless, competitive, stressful, and pressure-packed environment that basically sucked the curiosity out of children. In simplest terms.
Don't hold back. Tell us what you're really thinking, right? Really, what made it so?
So, I mean, it was a very high-ranking high school. So the only purpose for kids in this school was to get into a high-ranking college. Everything else was secondary. So there was cheating. There was a lot of pressure, competition. Everything was about getting high test grades and good grades in general. It just was not very an authentic environment altogether, and I very frustrated with it.
Did you tell people at the school that's how you felt?
Yeah, I mean, I told everybody. And I mean, the administration of the school wasn't exactly too pleased with my views, but I think that there's been a large movement around the country and around the world that has resonated with these ideas that I have.
So the title of your book sums it up, One Size Does Not Fit All. For those who don't fit, what do they do?
It's difficult because right now the school system is based on crushing the passions and the interests of children everywhere.
Nikhil, really? Really? High school is really designed to crush the passion of learning out of you.
So if you look at the way high schools were designed, and just school in general, the way school was designed back in the 19th century, it was designed to create people who would man the factories, people who are cogs in the machine. It was never designed to create ingenious and creative people. That was never the purpose of it. I mean, if you look at the functions of American schools, you have the age segregation. You have the fact that you're grouped by people by what people call the date of their manufacture. You have people going from class to class at the sound of a gong. You have an agrarian school calendar. Everything, almost everything in today's schools is antithetical to how human beings learn and function. And that's how it was designed. It wasn't designed to actually be based on that basis.
Michael, are you going to stick up for the good old-fashioned agrarian 100-year-old design school system here, or are you going to let him get away with that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more with what he's saying, you know, and I want to invoke the ghost of Egerton Ryerson, you know, because Egerton Ryerson, he invented our educational system here in Ontario. And I always say, they tell the story, Egerton Ryerson would take his watch out of his pocket at 10 o'clock in the morning, and he would very proudly say, "I can tell you what every student in Ontario is doing at this moment." And
he meant that as a good thing.
And he saw that as a good thing. And that legacy still exists in Ontario. We really believe that one size fits all, and we really believe in the factory model. And the idea of treating people differently, like we had the black focus schools in Toronto.
I was just going to push back on that. We have black focus schools, right. We have Aboriginal focus schools, we have gay and lesbian focus schools.
But look at the pushback they got, you know, and the kind of Ontario attitude is that you don't give special treatment to anyone. We teach to the gray middle. We teach to the normal, and whatever that is, and the rest of you just have to play along, you know.
So let's finish the story here. You finished high school. Are you going to go to college or university?
So I've decided to skip college at the moment. So I'm working on my second book at the moment and a number of projects in education.
Huh. So take me through a typical day. If you're not getting up in the morning, getting ready to go to classes or write papers or essays, what are you doing?
So, I mean, I really don't have a typical day. I may be in San Francisco or maybe in Dallas or maybe here. I mean, I do a lot of speaking. I do a lot of writing as well. I mean, most of my days are really spent reading and writing and communicating with people. And it's just a lot of fun because I've never felt so free in my life before. I've never had this kind of freedom before I was 5 years old. When I entered school, I never had this kind of freedom and liberty to do things.
No, the freedom's wonderful, but how are you paying your bills?
So I'm still living at home with my parents. But I think I could pay my bills if I decide to rent an apartment. But I just choose not to at the moment.
And they support what you're doing?
Absolutely. They're very supportive. At first, it was kind of difficult. They had to kind of unlearn a lot of the myths and the traditions of Indian education. But they're much more supportive of what I'm doing.
Do you not, and you haven't said you forswear ever attending post-secondary
right.
institutions, but does part of you worry about whether or not you'll be able to get as good a job or have as good a career as you might otherwise have had if you ultimately don't attend a post-secondary institution?
Right. So I would argue that the way the world is changing right now, more employers really don't care very much about that piece of paper or that degree in general. They're really caring about what you can do and how you can do it. I think the world in terms of jobs is based on your creativity, your interest, and your passion, more so on your originality than fitting in, just being like everybody else. If you have that 4.0 from Harvard, it's not going to really get you that far. It might get you a step in the door, but it may not necessarily get you a job.
But that's the point, and I wanted to push back on this. You see this in job ads all the time.
Right.
You know, MBA required,
yeah.
Master's degree required. That doesn't get you the job, but it gets you in the door.
Right.
What gets you in the door if you haven't got that piece of paper?
So, I mean, if you're a person who's doing amazing work, you're showcasing your work on the internet, in conferences, in media, you're naturally going to get people that are going to ask about you. They're going to be attracted to what you're doing. And I think the world of work, they're trying to find people who are talented, who are passionate, and who are doing amazing things. And I think the portfolio, a lot of employers are looking at portfolios. Google, for example, decided that they're not going to take much into account the GPAs and the test scores of people anymore because they found that the correlation was pretty low. So I'm seeing that they care more about the portfolio. They care more about what you can do. I mean, if you talk about how you mentioned how the degree could get you in the door, that's mm-hmm. certainly true, and I think that will happen for a fairly long time in the future. What I would say is that there's a lot of studies out there that find that most jobs are not advertised. They're really through word of mouth, through social media, or through connections. So if you have a network of people who are committed to what you're doing, they're going to naturally introduce you to people, and you can get a job through those means.
So in a way, your appearing on this program tonight is like writing a final exam and acing it.
You right? could say. I don't.
You're burnishing your credentials by being on this program. Okay, good for you. Okay, let's look at some more tape right now. There is, everybody knows Sir Ken Robinson, who has, if you watch YouTube at all, he's got some wonderful talks on YouTube about the nature of the education we're giving our kids around the world today. They say that the next Ken Robinson has now been found, and his name is Sugata Mitra. And he's a very delightful fellow and has a lot to say about education. Let's take a look at a clip of him, and we'll come back and chat. Roll tape, please, Sheldon.
How do children learn to use computers? Nobody seems to be actually teaching them. So I stuck a computer in a slum wall, a nice big computer in those days with a nice big broadband connection, in front of children who had never seen computers before, hadn't heard of the internet, had no clue what was going on, didn't know English. And they started browsing in about 5 or 6 hours' time. And then it happened over and over and over again everywhere, until the experiment kind of burst out onto the world media with the statement that children anywhere in groups can teach themselves to use a computer. There appears to be no limit to this, that children can teach themselves almost anything if given the internet, given the permission to interact with each other, and given the absence of the teacher. The absence of the teacher in the presence of the internet, can become a pedagogical tool.
The absence of teachers can be a pedagogical tool. Let's just, before we discuss that, remind everybody where we are tonight. We're at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, the place they call Lazaritasville. Here in Waterloo, Ontario, we are on night 2 of 5. All this week, we are going to be coming to you from this building, where we're looking at the nature of education today and going forward to the year 2030. That's why we've been calling this year-long series Learning 2030. If you couldn't be here, we have an opportunity for you to get involved in the program throughout the course of the evening. As you look here in the room above our guests, we've been seeing a constant Twitter feed. There it is right now. Live streaming on our website, theagenda.tvo.org. Live streaming on our special website, tvo.org/learning2030. And of course, available for live chatting on Twitter using the hashtag Learning2030, or because we're at the Equinox Summit, they have another one, EQX13. Okay, Michael, you're the teacher here, so I want to get your feedback on that last line of Mr. Mitra's there, which is, the absence of teachers can be a pedagogical tool. It doesn't seem to make sense on the face of it, but...
Yeah, particularly for the kind of kid coming into our schools today. The internet went public around 93. First web browser was 95-ish. So these kids born in the age of the internet are just finishing secondary school. Kids coming into school today have a totally different mindset from the one we did. We came from a pyramid world, top down, do what you're told. Why? Because I said so. Kids coming into our schools today, they want to know why this is relevant. They want to know why I should do this. And the answer, because I said so, isn't good enough. They're coming from a screen world where they have total control and total autonomy into an old 19th century factory model where there's a teacher standing at the front of the room telling them to do boring things.
The sage on the stage, as
it were. The sage on the stage, chalk and talk and so on. Mm-hmm. And this is the great conflict we face in schools today, is the cultural revolution we're living through as a result of the internet and this old 19th century pyramid model, top down, of the teacher at the front of the classroom. So in my latest book, I talk about the school of the future is the decentered school. School is going to have to become much more fragmented. And you're gonna have kids in the workplace, you're gonna have kids doing all different kinds of things. And it's interesting, in the discourse so far around this table, we've talked a lot about post-secondary. We've talked a lot about diplomas and degrees, and you congratulated me on my 4 kids and they're, you know, getting degrees. As though that was the only measure of a person's success.
It's a good measure, though, isn't it?
It's a measure. But I agree with the gentleman at the end. I think that the world is changing, and I think it's very interesting. Here we are at the Perimeter Institute, and one thing that Ontario needs to do is become more entrepreneurial. And the way kids become entrepreneurial is by people freeing them up.
Well, let me follow up on that with Sam, because I don't know if you've seen this video that Mr. Mitra did, where he puts a computer in the middle of a room in a poor Indian village. These kids have never seen a computer before in their lives. There's no instructor. They go up and start playing with it, and 5 hours later, they're surfing the web. They know what they're doing. Does that ring true?
I think it rings true, of course. And I think what it shows is that kids are resourceful, they're curious, they have these skills, they're great learners naturally, and they can learn a lot on their own. But that doesn't mean that the absence of teachers is the key, and I think we want to be careful there. So Michael's talking about a fragmented school, a decentralized school, and I completely agree. You know, I designed a school that was led by students, but I don't think absence of teachers are the key. Is the key on its own. Teachers are great. They're wonderful. They serve a great role, and I'm not just saying that because Michael's sitting 2 seats over. No, I think teachers serve a great role because, yes, those students were able to surf the web and gather information. And yes, in the 21st century, all of us, we're all growing up able to gather huge amounts of information on our own without some teacher at the front of the classroom teaching it to us. But teachers still have an enormous role in terms of guiding us, pushing us, teaching us things, modeling things like skepticism, and helping us become inspired to enjoy reading. So not having the teacher in the classroom at all, I think, is a huge mistake. Changing that teacher's role so they're not the sage on the stage, as you said, is key, but we still need them there because I think they have an enormous potential as experts, as experienced role models and guiders to be there to push these students much further, as she's talking about, challenge them further than they would otherwise.
Noor, how much of that do you agree with?
I agree. I think teachers are really important to students. I think that everyone knows can think of a teacher that shaped them. Like in the work that I'm doing right now, obviously there's no teachers, but there's mentors, and mentors are also really valuable people to seek out. But I think the key thing in any sort of relationship where you're trying to absorb information is that you have to seek them out. You have to be active and pursue and have very specific things that you're trying to achieve, right? So, you know, when you go to a teacher, you need to say, these are the things that I want. And the key thing, I think, about teachers and the way that education needs to change is that students need to be able to think from a longer perspective. They need to be able to project out for a year and say, where do I want to be a year from now? Where do I want to be 2 years from now? And teachers need to be helping those students get to that point, get to where they are going to be in a year, instead of, you know, laying down a curriculum and saying, this is where you're going to be in a year and this is how you're going to get there. Students need to have the initiative, the drive, the motivation, and the resources, the teacher, the institution, to be able to create that plan and create that path for themselves.
Kayla, help us with this. The qualities of a great teacher are what? It's funny that I've asked you, because of course you've just rejected them all, so.
You know, I'd actually like to clarify that that's not what I rejected. Rejected, I rejected the school environment. I persisted with a lot of different teachers, and they supported me in their own way.
And their qualities were what?
And their qualities, I feel a humility. I feel a mutual respect as learners, because I feel, as Sam said, that the key thing here is not that we don't need teachers, it's that we need to redefine together what that role is and make that more relevant for the 21st century, and also just humanize it a bit, because it's gotten into a bit of a power play sometimes, and a hierarchy I don't feel is reflective of the true relationship between humans outside of, or I don't think it should be anyway.
Nico, can you help us out with this question as well? Do we still need teachers in the classrooms of the future?
Yeah, and I think Sugata Mitra isn't exactly saying that we should just get rid of teachers. I think his premise is that first, that children are naturally curious people, that they are natural learners, and they have they are experts at learning. They can explore, discover, solve things, observe. They're just extraordinary human beings at that kind of age. So I would say that, absolutely, I agree with Sam and everyone that has been spoken before, that we do need teachers, and we do need to redefine their role in the sense that they are moving from this position of hierarchy where they're telling kids what to do all the time to one where it's a reciprocal relationship, where they're having this conversation with them, where they're giving feedback and advising them. And I think that kind of relationship is so much more powerful because then students will respect them much more. Right now, it's you have a teacher where, in a sense, which is a Machiavellian kind of figure, where who is supposed to be feared, who is supposed to be at the head of a classroom telling kids what to do. But now when it's redefining their role, now they're on the same platform. Now people can start engaging with one another on an equal setting.
Well, because the student doesn't really need the teacher to get information anymore.
Right.
The information's a click away everybody.
That's one part, but I think the guidance and the amount of just knowledge that teachers have is so, so important. And I think around the world today, we've gone on basically a teacher bashing campaign, and I think that's very, very harmful. We've destroyed unions, we've cut pay, we haven't given them enough benefits. I think teachers need to be so much more valued in our society, and most importantly, treated like professionals and what they call in South Korea nation builders. And they have a really tremendous role in our society today.
Michael, let me ask you a little more about that role. If you have an engaged, curious student, a teacher's job is one thing. If you have students who are not so curious, not so engaged, presumably the teacher's job is completely different?
Yeah, and this is one of the great stresses of teaching, is that very often you fall into crowd control, you fall into damage control, anger management, you know. And it's so important to say that teachers are as much, it's a strong word to say victims, teachers are as much victims of the system as kids are. Many teachers will tell you, I wish it was different. Many teachers watching tonight's show will say, yeah, this is all wonderful. I'd love to work in that kind of system, but it's not the kind of system we have now. And I think there's a real tendency to say, you know, those teachers are uphold, you know, the prison wardens love, you know, in a sadistic way, this power they have. No, teachers are stressed too, because teachers want to connect with kids. Teachers, a good teacher loves learning, loves kids. But in the province of Ontario, for example, we have a very curriculum-centered educational system. And the teacher really feels his or her job is to disseminate that curriculum. And so their hands feel tied as well.
Well, but you know why all this, I mean, much of what we have in place today was a response to parents who complained to politicians that our kids weren't learning the 3 R's well enough, that they didn't have any standardized test scores to look at to show evidence that they were learning something, and therefore we are where we are.
Yes.
Have we made a mistake?
Well, we're very much into standardized curriculum right now. I was a product of Living and Learning, the Hall-Dennis Report in the 1960s, and they called it cafeteria education. With the Mike Harris, the Common Sense Revolution, the pendulum swung to the other end, and we had a curriculum-centered, not child-centered, curriculum-centered. I think it's time for this pendulum to swing back, maybe not all the way toward child-centered, although that would be my wish, but we need to get away from this serving the curriculum. Right now, we have an outcomes-based curriculum, and the rubrics are there, and I call them the specifications for the manufacturer, and the yardstick is held up, and you are measured and found wanting. And all it does is create stress, stress, stress.
Sam, can you imagine a system, though? We're talking about building an entire education system for a country or a continent that could be that nimble that it could deal with all of the individual needs of each student.
So actually, the good news is we're not just designing one for a country or a continent, we're designing one for the whole world. And that's why some of us are here this week. And the other good news is that the kinds of things that we've been talking about up here, these more nimble educational approaches, they're actually much lower cost, much less resource dependent than some of the systems we have in place now. They don't require huge amounts of infrastructure and technology and textbooks. They require very simple principles. Now, I disagree slightly with Michael that we don't need an outcomes-based system. I think we do want goals for our education system, and maybe I misunderstood what you meant, but I think we do want goals. We just have a very outdated goal, as Nikhil pointed out. We have goals that are based on, you know, obtaining information, and now we need newer goals that are about making people, again, as I mentioned earlier, more able to appreciate evidence, slightly more nimble goals. But certainly, I can see schools all over the world, national systems, that are based on these basic principles of changing the role of the teacher and the student and changing the goals of our schools.
I know that's why you're all here, Nikhil, is to try to create a blueprint going forward for the world's education systems. Is that really doable?
Yeah, I think, so there's, around the world today, there are successful schools, and most people, that's often lost in the conversation. So for example, one of the things I've been researching for the past year for my second book is looking at Sudbury Democratic and Free Schools. And these schools have largely been around since the 1960s and 70s, really, the influence of these schools came from a school in England called Summerhill. And Summerhill was founded by a man named A.S. Neill. And his belief was that school should fit the needs of the child rather than the reverse. So these free schools and democratic schools, they're based on the premise that children are natural learners. That if you trust a child, if you realize that if you give them the resources, books, literate adults, an environment with a lot of freedom and creativity, they will all rise up to the occasion. And so I visited a lot of these schools, and it's amazing because I would argue that most schools today are, in some sense, totalitarian regimes, where you have a small percentage of the population, the adults, deciding on behalf of the rest of the population, the learners, on how to learn, what to learn, and where to learn. And these schools, it's entirely based on democratic process. So the students actually vote on school policies. They have democratic meetings. They also have a judicial process. So for example, a student breaks a ceiling fan. They actually have to go to trial, where there's a jury of their peers as well as an adult that decides based on the punishment of that of the child, and they have witnesses. It's an amazing process. So these schools are around there. The problem is that most of these schools are private schools. They desperately want to be public, but they don't want to follow the testing guidelines and the standards and the curriculum. So if we realize that politicians need to get away from this notion of technocratic kind of mentalities based on big data and numbers and statistics, and move towards a system based on humanistic values, based on the values that we want to see in human beings, generosity, humility, perseverance, happiness, self-worth, all the attributes we want to see in our future population, then that's the system we can create. And I think it's absolutely doable.
Michael, that would require a paradigm shift in thinking the likes of which we haven't seen here in 150 years. Are we capable of that?
I think so, and I think it's going to happen inevitably. And, you know, talking about Sudbury Valley Schools and all of these eclectic experimental schools, what do they have in common? They're intentional communities, where a group of parents have gotten together and said, this is what we want for our local school. And we're talking about the education system of the world and the education system of the country. I think that educational change will happen at the local school level when parents get involved in schools in meaningful ways. Again, the school council degenerates into fundraising, bake sales, and so on. My vision of a future education in Ontario is to have locally owned schools, owned by their communities, owned by their parent groups, where there are really substantive discussions about what we're doing in that school in terms of curriculum and in terms of budgeting, and also, as was mentioned, school culture. We are obsessed with scores, EQAO, for example. EQAO has a huge influence in our schools. Why aren't we testing student happiness? Why aren't we testing student wellness? If parents owned their local schools more, schools would change. And I talk to many parents who say, I would love to get in there and I would love to have more influence, but I don't feel welcome.
Well, try this quote on for size. This is V. Ledson, who's a former childcare owner, wrote this on Facebook after watching a video about unschooled, which is part of our conversation tonight, unschooled boys. She wrote, "Fortunate are the children who, when school doesn't fit, are able to have their needs met at home. Too many children are not so lucky. I was homeschooled for one terrible year, grade 4, and was thrilled to get back to school when it was over."
Sure, that's fine. You know, one size does not fit all.
Sam, go ahead.
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, I think homeschooling, you know, in your case, obviously was an amazing option, but that's the reason we need to try to create broader change. Now, I agree, you know, again, I worked at a very local level in my high school, and I hope that continues to happen, because every year that passes that the system doesn't change is another bad year. That said, we also need to be working with our policymakers on a broader scale, and things like this week here at Perimeter, to make change on a global scale.
Noor, you wanted to add.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think change in education happens the same way that change happens anywhere, right? It's people doing things, making things happen. And I think everyone needs to take some sort of ownership over this problem. No one's a victim. No one, you know, is powerless. And everyone just needs to say, okay, how much am I going to let happen? How much am I going to be passive? And how much am I going to say that, no, this is something that's really critically important, and this is something that I'm going to do something about, like, you know, like Sam did at his school. And, you know, everyone, you ask, you know, are we capable of it? It's not, we don't have to push this responsibility on other people. It's am I capable of it? Are you capable of it? Are we going to work together to make something happen? And, you know, Nelson Mandela, you know, says it perfectly. Everything is impossible until it's done. So let's just go and do it and, you know, stop talking about it.
So let's, Nikhil, yeah, I'm down to my last 30 seconds here. Maybe you could help us with this. Are we looking towards a future when technology will make it possible for there to be fewer teachers, but they will all be very excellent and they will all be better paid? And of course, their job will be completely different from what it is today.
Yeah, so there's a pretty wrongheaded notion, at least in the education conversation, that apparently technology and computers are just going to take over teachers. And then you have the whole ridiculous ed tech conversation, where you have all these companies that are only seeking to profit off of the backs of children, where they say that, oh, we can just replace all the teachers with these new kind of amazing devices. What I would say simply is that technology is a great tool, and that's what it is. I think It might certainly help with the classroom and the way teachers are functioning, but it's not going to replace the kind of conversation altogether, replace the teachers altogether. I think it's just a great tool for students to use and leverage altogether.
That's going to be the last word tonight. I want to thank the five of you for coming and helping us out with this, starting with Nikhil Goyle, the author of One Size Does Not Fit All, A Student's Assessment of Education, Noor Siddiqui, the 2012 Teal Fellow, Samuel Levin, the founder of the Independent Project at Monument Mountain Regional High School in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, Kayla Cohen from London, UK. She's left school, but she's still getting educated. And finally, Michael Reist, the author of What Every Parent Should Know About School. Great to have all five of you here tonight, and good luck with your work this week here at the Perimeter Institute. Tonight's program was produced by Vodek Schemberg and Harrison Lohman, and that is the agenda for Tuesday, October 1st, 2013. Tomorrow, we're back here again. We live in a world increasingly reliant on science and math. Problem is, science is not everybody's game, so we are going to explore how we can engage every student in science without the fear of failure. And of course, if you can't be in the hall here at Perimeter with us, we have all those ways for you to get engaged in our program. tvo.org/learning2030 is our special website. Our producers will be hosting a live chat there as well. So please join the conversation. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org. And we'll see you again tomorrow night here at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario.
Funding for The Agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders
one
since
more bit
1879.
Of applause to come still.
More information is available at icao.on.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.